See? Pretty impressive. Book of Exodus, chapter number 33, is where we're going to spend the majority of our time this morning. But I want to give us a little bit of a running start as a reminder of where we are and what we're looking to do. Exodus chapter number 33. So, where have we been? What have we looked at so far in this narrative of the of the working in the book of Exodus here? Anybody know what have we seen so far with the life of Moses? We don't know anything? Yeah, in order. Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly where we were. Last week we were looking at the fact that Moses had gone, and where was Moses at the time when the children of Israel began that process of determining that they were going to break the covenant essentially that God had established? The rules that had been put 40 days earlier into place, they said, you know what, we're gonna ignore those, we're gonna do it our own way. Where was Moses? Top of the mountain of Sinai, right. He was with God at the time, talking with God. All right. And what caused the children of Israel to fall into that sin? What was it that kind of motivated that for them? Impatience. That was a big part of it, right? They were impatient. They wanted to know what was going on. And they had a leader at that point who had done some pretty miraculous things. How far removed were they at this point from their experience in Egypt? From the time that they had gotten the covenant, right? But at that point, they were still not very far into the wilderness. I mean, this is shortly after they've crossed over. They've seen God working. Remember last week we talked about the fact there was a sense of anticipation in their hearts. They thought, you know what? This is it. This is going to happen. We're going to the promised land that God has given us. We're going to get an opportunity to see this land flowing with milk and honey. We're excited. And suddenly they stop at the base of this mountain. Moses goes and he gets these tablets from God, and this explains the expectations that God has. But during that period of time, something very significant happened. They were impatient for one thing. They wanted to get moving, but there was something else as well in terms of the visibility of their understanding of God. So who was Moses to them? So hold on. There's two things. What was that? Yeah. Right, and in some ways, that's what God wanted them to see. He was the intermediary, the mediator between them and God. So, yeah, that was all they knew. That's all they saw. So if Moses disappears, well, then we have no concept or any kind of reality with regard to Yahweh. Apparently, he's gone. So there was a sense in which they were very much, part of their impatience and part of this struggle in their heart was born out of the fact that Moses, he wasn't there, and they didn't really have that tangible thing. Remember, we talked about something, they wanted something they could bolt down, something they could kind of keep still, not something that could wander off on them. They wanted a representation of God that they could hold on to, because it makes it a lot more tangible for them. What were you saying? Same kind of concept. It was really, in a lot of ways, what we see now today in these people that are looking for the, almost like the lucky rabbit's foot. God is my tangible good luck charm that I'll use at my leisure. And there was a degree to which their response to the way that they wanted to worship God centered around that idea that we want a God who we can kind of just, we can see and know and feel and touch, and that we don't have to wonder about where he's at. And so they begin this process. And remember, one of the things that we pointed out in the passage previous to this section we're going to is that there was definitely a conflict in this. So it wasn't, you know, sometimes it's easy to get in your mind that this was something where they were, well, poor people, it's hard because they don't really know about God. And so I'm sure that it was really born out of a spirit of a good-natured desire to see and love God. And, man, this thing is just bugging me today. Hold on. To see and love God and to know him in their own way. And so, you know, we got to give them space. You know, they're growing. They're growing in their understanding of him. They're growing in their knowledge of what he's about. And so it's okay. They were just honest seekers. And remember last week I told you there were two commentators that wanted to give especially Aaron that benefit of the doubt, where they're like, well, he was just trying to do what he knew to do as best he knew how, to just make him at least stick around long enough for Moses to get down so that God could kind of clarify what his expectations were. But one of the things that's clear in this narrative, and one of the things that we identify, is that there is a conflict that develops in this relationship. There is a strong conflict that kind of degrades very quickly, right? So what's the first sign of the conflict? What's the first thing that happens that shows that this is not just a simple misunderstanding? Is there any conflict nature or any kind of conflict communication that is occurring? Do you guys remember that? Not in chapter 33. You guys don't look in 33. This is actually more in 32. That's true, but we haven't got there yet. So yes, there is definitely conflict that follows, but how does it all start? Where do you first see the conflict develop? Chapter 32, verse 1. When people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods who should go before us. As for this Moses, or what's his name, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know now what has become of him." So remember, we identified the fact that the language that's being expressed even there initially is this, it's an impatient, angry, almost a bullying type of conversation. This was not them honestly seeking after God. This was saying, we want what we want and we want it now. Get up, make us gods. We're done waiting for Moses. We're done waiting for God's way of, and we're not going to work in the way that he expects. We're going to do this our own way. So they ask Moses to make them gods, Aaron to make them gods. So this conflict already is established, right? So what happens? Do you guys remember what did Aaron do as expected? He absolutely did. He said, okay, sounds good, let's do that. And remember, there was something pretty significant that we identified about how they went about doing this. So how did Aaron get what was needed to make this representation of Yahweh for them? He did what? Yeah, collected all the gold you can find. I want all your earrings. I want your bangles. I want your barrettes. I want whatever you've got that is made out of gold, and I'm going to use that to build this representation of Yahweh. So remember, we identified that there's something pretty unique about that in regards to how it eventually became true when they did build the tabernacle, which, by the way, is the tabernacle a tangible representation of the relationship that they had with God? It was. So before you get all bothered by the fact that they wanted this, God actually allowed them to have that. He said, I will dwell in your midst. I will bring my tabernacle here into the middle of you, and I will indwell that, and you will see my cloud over it, and you will know that I am here, and that I am actually with you. So it's not that what they were asking for is completely aberrant or completely outside of what God's plan was. It's just that they were doing it their own way, right? That was the biggest issue at this point, is that they wanted to do it their own way. So when that happens with the tabernacle, how does that process go? Does Aaron and Moses go out and say, give us all your earrings with a gun in your chest? Of course not. They say, hey, whatever the Spirit lays on your heart, bring. And in that setting, there was so much gold that was brought that they had to stop them. All right. And so there's a pretty significant thing that you see there, which reminds us, and we talked about this, I don't know if it was last week or 2 weeks ago, that when you try to follow or do your own, make your own agenda with God and say, I want to do this my way, I want to approach God in my way, you actually enslave yourself. It becomes bondage. Whereas if you follow God's plan, there is a sense of true freedom. And the same thing may happen, but the motive behind it and the process by which it occurs is completely different. And that's the beauty of following God and his plan, is that when you do it his way, he's pleased, and you are because you're doing it within the construct of his design, you're benefited, and you enjoy it, and you enjoy him. But that's not what occurred here. In this case, it is demanded by Moses or by Aaron, and so they get all this stuff together, and they make this golden calf. And remember that when we saw this, you know, they all said, okay, fine, this is it, this is the God. Aaron got nervous, and so he started to establish this religious process so that at least it had some measure of seriousness and pomp and circumstance. You don't want this to completely devolve into something that's completely outside of God's plan. But what happens anyway? In spite of the fact that he establishes these rules and regulations and standards, he says, okay, we're going to have a feast day to the Lord. This is nothing different, guys. This is the same thing. And remember, we identified the fact that when someone tells you, well, it's the same thing, it's just a different way of doing it, you have to be careful to make sure that that's actually true. Because in this case, he wanted it to sort of be the same thing. Yeah, Moses, golden calf, whatever. As long as we're still having the feast day of the Lord, it's all good. But it wasn't all good. Because they were doing it their own way, and it devolved into something terrible. So much so that when Moses and Joshua come down the mountain, and Joshua hears the sound, and I think this is where we're going to pick it up for this week. Joshua hears that sound, and he assumes it's a battle. So verse 15 there of chapter 32. Then Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hands, tablets that were written on both sides, on the front and on the back they were written. And the tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. Then Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, and he said to Moses, "There is a noise of war in the camp." But he said, "It is not the sound of shouting for victory, or the sound of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing that I hear." And as soon as he came near the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, and Moses' anger burned hot, and he threw the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf that they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it on the water and made the people of Israel drink it. So now we definitely have conflict. Whereas before we weren't entirely sure, now there's no question. Now remember, between the period of time where they made this choice to pursue God in their own way, what was going on the mountain with relationship to Moses and God? And this is what you identified early on, is the fact that they had God and Moses were having this conversation where God was developing in the heart of Moses specifically. Remember, this is something that Moses and God were talking about. God develops in the heart of Moses this compassion. He is growing compassion in Moses for the people of God. God gave him an opportunity. We identified this last week. God said, "Hey, tell you what, let's just start over, you and me. Let's just get rid of these stiff-necked, stupid people that are down there already breaking the rules that I am giving to you now. They're already messing up. Let's just do away with them. Let me just kill them all. And let's start with you. Let's have the covenant come through you and your seed." How's that sound, Moses? What do you think? Now, in one sense, you could look at that, and as Moses, you have to believe that, and let's be honest for a second, is this a pretty substantial offer? Yeah. This is the covenant of God. You could become the Abraham of Israel, which is kind of what he was anyway, because he was still Moses. But the fact is, you could actually end up in a very, you know, in a pretty substantial position of honor and respect. Moses could have really taken advantage of this opportunity. Why would God have presented this? And that's an interesting question. Remember, we talked about this last week as well. The question of why does God do things anthropomorphically, in the sense that he begins to do this stuff and he says, "Hey, I'm angry, I'm mad with these people, and I'm just gonna do away with them. I'm done with them." Why was it that he was making those statements to Moses? Because he wanted to draw out from Moses his true heart. He wanted to grow in Moses an understanding of what his role was exactly. Moses was the go-between. He was the mediator between the people of God, people of Israel, and God. That was his role. And so suddenly, you know, that role only works if it's two ways, right? If he would have thought, "You know what, I'm the go-between, so I have this stiff-necked people over here that I can't stand, and but I do it because I have to. God, you and I both know we hate them, but here I am." It doesn't work that way. That's not what the role of mediator provides. The role of mediator is a two-way communication, an opportunity for somebody to stand between a justly angered God and say, "Your people need forgiveness." When we see Christ stand before God and receive the lashes, the stripes that were mine, we see him in loving favor responding to my sin and saying, "Forgive them. Yes, we know they're sinful, but I love them. God so loved the world that he gave his son." That is the thing that needs to be identified here with Moses. This can't just be, it's not like Moses is just somehow this blob that has no will toward either the people of Israel or toward God. He is playing the role of mediator. And so God is growing that in him and showing him, "I have every right to be angry, but because of your expression of desire for on behalf of the people, because that's true, this just isn't working. I have to take it off in a second." Tell me. Wait, no. Can't stand you. Yeah, this might be easier. Thank you. Brilliant. I don't know why they ever invented these things. I think it's a bad plane. But for me, it's better, because otherwise, if it was on my tie, it'd be every which way. So the thing is, with this relationship that you see and the way that it's developed, you recognize that God had done this process with Moses to identify or to show or to display for Moses the fact that he is playing the role of the go-between. And that is developed as we see this story go further. So the conflict then gets out of hand, right? And you see him come down. Now here's something that's kind of interesting. When we see this section, and it talks about the fact that Moses took those tablets and he smashed them at the foot of the mountain. There are many times when people say, wow, that guy, you know, he really should have had more control over his temper. He really should have done a better job of you know, being careful with his attitude and with his responses. And in fact, I've heard many times people say that was one of the sins that Moses commits. But I don't ever see this identified as a sin. I actually think this was a representation of what had occurred. When Moses took those covenants, he says, this is the physical representation. You guys want a physical representation of your relationship with Yahweh? I'll show you. This right here is a tablet that God himself made. Not Aaron. I mean, who's this guy? This is God himself. But you have already, in your response to God, you have shattered this. You have broken it. Already, it's still hot off the press, and you're already messing it up. And he destroys this thing as a representation of the fact that the Israelite nation had already broken or shattered their covenant with God. And his anger burns hot, and he takes that representation, that physical thing that they had, and he burns it with fire, and he grinds it up, and he puts it in the water. Here's a question I have for you. Is this something that can be done in a short period of time? Not at all. This is a process. This is not something, it's not like, you know, taking bone china, I'm so mad, and then it's over, you know. It's not. This is gold. This has to be burned down, and it has to grind up gold into a powder. This is a long process. This is not, so when we talk about the idea of Moses' anger burning hot, immediately in your mind you see this guy that's just flying off the handle. But what he's doing takes time and thought, and he's continuing to display to the children of Israel the repercussions of their sin. And he is doing it over a period of time. He goes through this entire process of grinding and powdering this gold, and he lays it on the water, and then he tells them, drink it. Why? Do you ever ask yourself that question? What's the point of the drinking? Why would that matter? Is it just so that they get a bad taste in their mouth and so that they feel sick in their stomach? I mean, what's the point of the drinking? That to me was it was a weird thought. Why would he make them drink it? What do you guys think? Throw out some ideas there. Because it doesn't say. But I think there's something that we can gather from what's not said. Why? Why drink it? Okay. So there's a possibility, and you're headed in an interesting direction there. Is it possible that he's trying to show them that God, this idea of the representation of God, it's not something you can bolt down. It's something that you consume. It's something that becomes part of who you are. I think that's a pretty good thought. Anybody else have any other thoughts? Sure. Yeah. And I think that's possible as well. There might have been some that were under the impression that that was actually the God. Although we will say that most of the time, Aaron and the other children of Israel used language of, this is like God. I don't know that they necessarily were under the impression that the golden calf itself was the God. Some of the pagan nations with Baal and those, they actually worshiped them as an actual God. Whereas in this case, they wanted something that represented Yahweh. They even said, this is the Lord, this is Yahweh. So to some level, although they still had this sense of superstitious attachment to it, bowing down before it, saying, okay, well, fine, this is like God. So there is a degree to which I would agree with that as well, saying, look, you guys made this and I can destroy it. It's gold. It's just something you have. It's not something that actually is powerful enough to defend itself and to stop me from utterly obliterating it, completely destroying it. So yeah, that's definitely a possibility as well. Anybody else have any other thoughts about why he made them drink it? I think both of those are probably pretty close to what I see, and in fact, most commentators will go there as well, so well done. The fact is that, especially when we look at the idea of the fact that Moses was showing them, you can't have this external God. You have to have a God that's personal, a God that you can that is part of who you are. You can't just keep him at an arm's distance and say, well, the good news about our God or our representation of God is that he's in it over here in this idol. And so if I want to step far enough away, well, maybe he won't see or know me. He won't understand my sin. And so I can do my own secret sin, but I have no God that, you know, my God is separate from me. That's not the case. This God was an intimate part of their being. So they drink this, right? And they smash it and he has them drink it in punishment for what was occurring in regards to their relationship. So, we've already been through this. So the conflict develops, right? And then there's the consequences that come from that. And when Moses saw the people had broken loose, and this is in verse number 25. Let's go to verse number 21. And when Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you have brought such great sin upon them? And Aaron said, let not the anger of my Lord burn hot. You know the people, and they are set on evil. For they said to me, make us gods who shall go us before us. And for this, as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. So I said to them, let any who have gold take it off. So they gave it to me. And I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. I think that's such a funny statement from Aaron. Like, really? That's really what the story you're going to go with? That's pretty unfortunate, really. And you, again, this is why it's very difficult for me to give him some space and say, well, he was trying. That's really his argument. He's saying, hey, it's not my fault. They're really persuasive and they're really mad and they're kind of tough. And so I just decided I'd go with what they said. And, I didn't really have much say in the matter. And you notice that Moses is actually calling him to account. Moses is saying, look, it's on your head. You did this. What is it that they did? How is it that they managed to manipulate you sufficiently to cause you to do this? Because I sure hope it wasn't of your own will. He's like, look, this better not be your idea. And he says, oh, but yeah, it wasn't. It sure wasn't. It was the people. And I didn't really know what I was doing. And when Moses saw that the people had broken loose, for Aaron had let them break loose to the derision of their enemies, then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, who's on the Lord's side? Come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered around him, and he said to them, thus says the Lord God of Israel, put your sword on your side, each of you, and go to and fro from gate to gate throughout the camp, and each of you kill his brother, and his companion, and his neighbor. And the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses. And that day about 3,000 men of the people fell. And Moses said, today you have been ordained for the service of the Lord, each one at the cost of his son and of his brother, so that he might bestow a blessing upon you this day. This next section of scripture and this next section of our narrative is talking about the consequences of the actions that were taken on the part of Israel at this point. So you see this anger expressed, this just, righteous anger, as Moses says, do you not realize, do you not see what you have done in saying, I will do it my way, not God's way? And so he goes and says, I am going to draw a line in the sand. That whole idea of drawing a line in the sand, you see this all the time in the Old Testament, and it's really cool. We don't do that anymore. But back then, it was for real. It was legit. You take a sword and you make yourself a line and say, who's on God's side? I am tired of trying to, say, well, I'm on, God's side most of the time, as long as he's nearby, as long as he blesses me, and as long as I can manipulate him like I can manipulate a golden cow. But I don't want a God that's powerful enough to be mad at me for things that I don't want to tell him I did. And so they say, he draws this line and says, who's on the Lord's side? Who's going to come with us as an expression of devotion to God? And the sons of Levi are the only ones that cross that line. I have a question for you. This man has just destroyed your golden image, has ground it up, put it in the water. He's smashed the covenant. You know that he has been the representation of God himself. At this point, what would possess you not to cross that line? Why would you not say, we're with God? You're right. At this point, I think that there's a degree to which, and you see this in our own life as well, we know we screwed up. We know we mess up. And God comes to us and he says, do you not see what you've done? And suddenly we find ourselves at this moment of choice where we have to choose between our own pride. Well, and you see this in Aaron's response. Yeah, sorry about that. I know it was kind of bad, but it wasn't maybe as bad as you're making it out. Dude, don't overreact, okay? Yeah, we probably messed up a little bit, but hey, admittedly, you were gone and, we weren't real sure. So it's not as bad of a sin as you're making it out to be. And when he takes his sword and he draws a line, he says, I want you to make a full, full admission of guilt. I want you to completely cross this line and say, not hold back some areas. Well, it was bad, and I'll give you like 50% of the sin there, but the other part, I really just can't see that as sin. When he draws that line, he says, who's on God's side? Who believes God and takes him at his word? Who is willing to fully admit that you're with God and not against him? And at this point, the sons of Levi cross that line. As a group, as a unit, which I think is also kind of cool. Because I think that's also a reflection of the fact that within that family, there is an understanding of the significance of their, first off, their role and their relationship within the nation of Israel. And they had a heritage that I think was playing into this, where they admit guilt and say, because it doesn't say that they weren't part of this thing that went down. I have a feeling that some of them might have. They might have been some of the people that were waiting, whoa, God, yeah, we know you're this gold bull, but we love God. And they might have been participating in that. But at this point, they admit that we're on God's side entirely. And then Moses asks them to do something incredibly, I don't think that this can be overstated, one of the most horrific things that could be asked of anybody that wants to serve God. Because what he's asking them is, are you willing to be in the ministry? Right? Are you willing to come onto God's side? Are you willing to be for him and him alone? Yeah, okay, we're in. They crossed that line. And Moses says, good, I'm glad you're here. I want you to grab your sword. All right, this is going in a direction that I'm not super comfortable with. Put it on your side, okay? Buckling your sword on, all right? Now take that sword and I want you to go and kill your brother, your son, your friend. I want you to kill your people because of the sin that they have committed before God. I'm sorry, what was that? What is it that you're asking of me? As a man, hold this sword and look from gate to gate in this city, and I see these people that God has called to be his own, and as I recognize my role as a minister to them, you're asking me to kill them with my sword? Are you kidding me? Are you sure? That's God's expectation. That is what is required. And so they take that sword, and for the rest of the day, they wander through the camp, killing people that they knew, people that they perhaps love, because of the consequences of the sin that they collectively as a nation had done. This is just mind-boggling. Why? Why would God demand this of these men? Why would God demand this? What is the point of this? Because there has to be a point. Is this just an arbitrary, vindictive God that has no concern for people and isn't willing to give them a chance to grow? What are we seeing here reflected? And the willingness that he had to go through, the sacrifice, the punishment that was necessary. The thing is, we, just like the children of Israel, like to downplay the consequences of our actions. We like to pretend like, well, yeah, it probably wasn't the best choice. And yeah, God, I probably knew better. Think for a moment that you're one of the Levites. You have a sword in your hand because you've chosen to follow God. But earlier in that day, or in that period of time, you had been part and parcel with the sin. And in your mind, you're thinking, why didn't I say something earlier? Why didn't I stop this? Now the consequences have grown tremendously, and I have to share in the agony. We think, wow, the people that died, that must have been hard. The people that lived, that had to carry out God's punishment, that would have been harder. To live with the rest of your life remembering that day when you had to participate in the consequences of the sin that you had let happen. This was strengthening the resolve of the individuals who were going to be called to be leaders within that group. Listen, go with God always, because the consequences are not worth it. It'd be easy to fight somebody you hate. It'd be easy to kill somebody that did wrong. But it points out, and it goes to great lengths to say, your son, your brother, this is people you know. It is hard, hard, hard work to be all with God. It's not an easy thing. It's not something that you can just take lightly and say, well, sure, I'm with God and you know, I'll go with him as long as I can. God says, if you're gonna be for me and with me, be willing to sacrifice. things you love dearly. Does this remind you of something that's commissioned? So we think, oh, well, this is Old Testament. This is just the judgment of the Old Testament. And this was that old God that was just trying to display his anger and justice and all that. But now we have the loving Christ of the New Testament. Does this sound familiar? What does it remind you of? You have no part of my kingdom. Yeah. If you don't hate your mother and your brother and your son, you have no part of my kingdom. Listen, we don't like putting this in our brochures. When we put a track out on someone's door, we don't want them to say, hey, you should come to Camp Christianity. It's a lot of fun. We have pools. We have tennis. You'd really like it. You should come. There's a lot of, let's call it seeker sensitivity, that longs to have that be the image of Christianity. That longs to have this Christianity that's so warm and cuddly and so comfortable that it just is it's practically a pleasure cruise. You're welcome to come as you feel led. And, you know, if you want to participate, then fine. But if you don't, listen, your call. Just join with us in this wonderful, good feeling expression of God. And I agree that that is what happens as you grow in your relationship with God, is that it becomes a wonderful experience. But it does not diminish the righteous holiness of my God. I have to be willing to say, God, I'm on your side, regardless of what happens in the process. And I'll tell you this now, if you're expecting that this is something that will not happen, you're wrong. Because the fact is, if you're for truth, it will, by necessity, by virtue of the fact that you're claiming truth, absolute truth, you are already in conflict with the majority of our culture. Because our culture says, well, truth is something you can decide on your own. Truth is something you can kind of come to at your own, you know, your own speed, at your own level. And yeah, you may think that that's what should be done, but that's just your opinion and I have my own and let's just get along. I don't know how often you see those coexist stickers on the back of these cars and this thing that says, listen, can't we just love each other? I mean, they just want to worship a golden bowl and you can worship God Yahweh on stone tablets. It's the same diff. No big deal. Let's just, at least it all points to God. At least we have the feast of the Lord. Hey, they're getting exposed to it. Maybe they'll come to your party soon. The thing is, there is a degree to which we have embraced that within our own culture as well. Where we've said, it's all right. It's not a big deal. It's not that big of a problem. And you know, yeah, we really should love God, but they're family. And so I don't really want to get on their bad sides entirely because I have to live with them. So I'm more than willing to tell some random person that they're wrong, but it's much, you know, telling family, well, that gets messy. So I'll keep that to myself. You can't do that. You can't do that. God has demanded commitment, full, unbiased, unabashed commitment to him and his plan. You can't reserve or hold things back. And that's essentially the message that's being drawn out here in these Levites is as they're going through this process, they are realizing and recognizing with every blow, God, I love you more than anything else. And even though I cannot, and maybe I'm wrong and maybe I'm too soft, but in my mind, that the blow that slaughters the individual in front of me would evoke from me, I probably couldn't see through my tears as I am killing these people that I love, but I love God more, and I'm willing to stand on that side of the line. And that's what happens in the camp. 3,000 men fall. And Moses says, today you have been ordained. Well, oh, so now we know how ordination works. We always wondered what ordination was. Whew. Today you have been ordained. You have been set apart and called. You have been ordained for the service of the Lord. Each one of you at the cost of his son and his brother, so that he might bestow a blessing upon you this day. This is not cheap. This is not something that you can fall into and fall out of. This consecration by God that occurred by blood was something that will last in their memory to the day they die. They will remember vividly the moment when God consecrated them to his service. And they will remember the penalty of not following God and his plan. What it cost them and what it cost others. Why do pastors get passionate? Why do they get overboard? Why do I talk your guys' ear off until you're like, please go home? It's because the fact of the matter is, this is serious business. This is not something that can be taken lightly. And it's not just something that I'm called to. It's something we're all called to. It's something we all have equal share in and responsibility. And that is to fight for truth in the life of people around us. It's a requirement. It's part of this process. And there's no question, as you see this occurring, that this was a very clear, vivid image that was brought to the minds of the people. The next day Moses said to the people, "You have sinned a great sin. And now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." Wow. So after a day of slaughter, after weeping and wailing and crying and people burying their dead, and this whole sense of complete and utter confusion about what comes next, Moses stands before the people as the mediator and says, "You sinned and you know it, and we all know it. Perhaps." Talk about giving them confidence, right? "It's possible. I can make an atonement for this sin. I will try for you. But we don't know." So the people are left with that message from Moses as he walks out of the camp again. So what happens? What was the thing that brought this all on? The fact that Moses had left and they got impatient. And suddenly the same thing that had happened before was happening again. Why? Why does God continually bring his people back through this same lesson? What is the point of this? He wants them to see it for what it is. They've got to learn this. They've got to understand what the message is that he wants them to hear and know. Your God, Yahweh, he's holy, he's righteous, and he deserves respect and patience and willingness to let him lead you on his terms. You can't do it your way. This is God's way. This is how God has chosen to do it. He's working through Moses. You wait and listen for God as he comes back and speaks through Moses. And so he says he's gonna go. So Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people have sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold. But now, if you will forgive their sin. But if not, please blot me out of your book that you have written." But the Lord said to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. But now go, lead the people to the place which I have spoken to you. Behold, my angels shall go before you. Nevertheless, the day when I visit, I will visit their sin upon them." Then the Lord sent a plague on the people because they made the calf, the one that Aaron made. And the Lord said to Moses, "Depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought up to the land of Egypt, to the land which I have sworn to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, 'To your offspring I will give it.' I will send an angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanites and the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people." We're going to stop here with this last thought for this morning. So we have this carnage before us. The stench of death is still in this camp. 3,000 people have been slaughtered. It's morning. Moses calls the remaining people in front of him and says, "I am going to God again. And I'm going to beg that he will protect and not punish you more than he has." And he leaves the camp. And at that moment, the people of Israel are left waiting. They're wondering, what's coming? What's next? What's left? There's still the mourning that's occurring as people have lost their sons and their fathers and their brothers, and they're thinking, what does God want? And Moses goes up before God, and he makes a full admission. "Alas, Lord, your people have sinned." He told God what God already knew. He told God what God had already told him. God was the one that first identified the fact that this was going on. Remember, the first time he was up on the mountain, he says, "Hey, go, because they're already doing this thing." And he comes back up and he makes a full admission. He says, "Your people have sinned against you. They have begun to worship these gods. But Lord, if you could forgive them." And I like how that thought is interrupted. He says, if you could forgive them, but if you can't, Lord, blot me out of your book. Take me. Let me stand in their place. Let me be their substitute." What do you hear in that? I hear Christ, the mediator, the ultimate substitute. saying, your people, God, have sinned. They have violated the commands that you've given. They have violated the covenant that you have made. They have sinned. But Lord, take me. Let me stand in their place. Let blot me out of your book. Take me out of the picture so that they can live. To which the Lord responds, I will not do that. I will not. I will hold them accountable for their sin. And he makes a very specific thing. He says something very specific. You see this especially in chapter 33, the first few verses there. He says, I am done with these stiff-necked people. What is a stiff-necked person? We don't really use that terminology very much anymore. It's actually an agricultural word. I have seen a perfect illustration of stiff-neckedness. So in this case, we recently went riding with Aaron and Carrie and Parker, and we went riding at this place up in Wellington. Oh, Wellington, yeah, good place. Woo! Thanks, all right. He's from Wellington. We went riding up there, and Carrie got on the horse. So before that, the ladies who were letting us ride their horses, they were letting the little kids up on there, and they're just walking this horse around with a halter. And so it was fun, the kids are on there, woohoo! So there for like an hour, hour and a half or so. And then they said, well, do any of the adults want to ride? And Carrie's like, well, I definitely want to ride. And so she gets on this horse, and she's ridden before, I assume, a couple times. So she knows generally. She looked like she knew what she was doing. She had the halter, and she was – or the reins at this point, I suppose. Was it still the halter? It was still the halter? Okay, so she had the leader, which maybe was a problem. But and she's riding this horse around, and then all of a sudden you see the horse, like, she wants it to kind of go in this big circle. So she gets halfway around the circle, and then it just starts to, like, turn out this direction. And she's like, and she's trying to pull it, and the ladies are like, pull her head. She's like, I'm trying. And so this horse is like starting to walk with its head turned, but it's still walking in a straight line. And you think, well, where's it gone? What's going on? What's this horse doing? And it goes up over this hill, and then it goes down over the other side of this hill, and you think, where's it going? And then you realize shortly after that, it's going into the barn. That's where it's going. It's going home. It's going in the barn. At that point, it's done. You know, I've had a bunch of kids. I'm good. You guys are good. You're all happy. I'm going home. And so it walks into this barn, and she couldn't stop. She wanted to stop because the barn was kind of low. And so she's, like, trying to stop. And so she finally, like, ducks under the beam, and, like, it goes in there. And then it just, like, finally parks in front of its stall and says, get off. Give me some food. That's stiff-necked, right? That's what stiff-necked means. It means I am unwilling to listen to the commands of the person who's in charge. I have my own agenda, my own plan, and my neck will be stiff in that direction. I'm unwilling to turn my head. In spite of what's being yanked on, I will not. I am going where I'm going to go. God says, my people are stiff-necked. They will not listen to what I'm telling them. They will not do what I've told them to do. They have their own agenda, their own plan, and nothing's going to sway them from that. They are walking where they're going, and there's no stopping them. He says, these people are stiff-necked. Why even bother? I'll tell you what. Here's the plan. I'll give you a land flowing with milk and honey. I'll give you a promise and a blessing, same covenant that I made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Same thing, all the same thing, but one. I'm out. Because if I go with them, if I'm there, I'll probably kill them. Because they're so stiff-necked and they don't care about what I think. So here's my plan. I'll let you have all the benefits, all the joys, all the pleasures of me and what I promised without me. That's his offer. You know what's interesting about that? If most Christians today had that offer from God, we'd be like, woo! Man, what a relief! I'm so glad because now I get all the benefit of heaven and the joy of all of the things that God said he would bless his believers with without the responsibility of being in charge of, or being responsible to any God. I mean, that sounds like a pretty sweet deal, does it not? What is the response that's made? We'll look at that next week. The response that comes out is astounding. And that's really where we're going to start transitioning. Because remember, we're talking about drawing near. And up to this point, we've seen primarily how the nation of Israel, it's unfolding for them who this God is. We've also seen in a narrower sense how it has been unfolded to the sons of Levi, who this God is. It's even more narrowly unfolded for Aaron, who this God is and what his expectations are. But at the singular point where we kind of trace it all back, Moses is learning who God is. And a lot of this dialogue that we're hearing, the sons of Levi don't hear. the Israelites don't hear. Aaron doesn't hear. It's for Moses. Moses is hearing, and he is being drawn near to the heart of God, and he is beginning to understand what it means to play the role of stand between. And that is a beautiful, beautiful picture of the gospel and of what God's doing in our own life as we take up the cross and follow him. Let's pray. God, thank you so much for the chance that we have to see, Lord, your holiness displayed. Lord, we are so quick to transform you into a teddy bear, to make you this soft, fuzzy God who doesn't really care about whether we sin or whether we do things that are wrong. But God, you're not that God. You are holy and righteous, and you deserve, Lord, our obedience. You demand our obedience. We owe it to you. Lord, I pray that you'll help us as we consider our own relationship with you. Lord, I pray that you'll burn into our hearts the importance of staying steadfastly committed to your side, not to our own agenda. Lord, I pray that you'll give us patience to wait for your plan, not to make our own way and to turn what you want to accomplish into our life into action points of spirituality that are meaningless apart from your spirit and the power of your plan. Lord, I pray that you will help us to see in clear terms how often we are unwilling to sacrifice for the sake of truth and for your gospel. And Lord, I pray that you'll break us of that. Lord, that you will change that in us. Lord, give us an opportunity to walk to the other side of that line, to be all in commitment to you and to your plan. Nothing holding back. Lord, I pray that that will be a characteristic that our church has, that people, when they encounter us, will see individuals who are so fully committed to God and his agenda that nothing else can stand in the way. Lord, we love you. We want to honor and glorify you in your name. And it's in your name that we pray all of these things. Amen.